In this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking about Chile with a journalist who has a lot of personal history with Chile, going back to the administration of Salvador Allende and the coup that toppled him in 1973. Our guest is Mark Cooper. He was a translator for Salvador Allende at that time of the Chilean coup. He currently is contributing editor of The Nation magazine. He's also host of the nationally syndicated program Radio Nation, a show that we run here on our station on Wednesday nights. His journalism has appeared in many different publications, including The New Yorker, Harper's, and Rolling Stone. He's authored a new book about his experiences in Chile, which is titled Pinochet and Me. It's published by Verso, and it's out now if you'd like to look at it. And as we talk this morning, your questions, of course, are welcome. All we ask of callers is people just try to be brief, only so we can keep the program moving along and getting as many different people as possible. But, of course, anybody who's interested can join the conversation. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line, good anywhere you can hear us, around Illinois, Indiana, anywhere the signal will travel, 800-222-9455. Mr. Cooper, hello.
Good morning to you, David.
Thanks for talking with us. We appreciate it. Just to start out, I guess you talk about in the book about your going to Chile and becoming the translator for Salvador Allende at the tender age, I think, of 22.
Right.
How is it that you ended up at that point in your life in Chile?
Well, as I say in the book, I owe it all to the then governor of the state of California and former president, Ronald Reagan, back in the early 1970s, like many people of my generation, I was active in the movement against the war in Vietnam and going to school at a state university in Southern California, one that was very active. And I had been studying Latin America and Chilean politics and was quite interested because of the extraordinary events that surrounded the election of Salvador Allende. And I literally got chucked out of the state college I was going to by executive order of the governor, who was trying to clamp down on the anti-war movement. And I thought that would be a good opportunity to take a break and go down to this place that I had been studying and see what it was like in real life. And I got to Chile when I was 20 years old, and after I was there a month or two, decided I wanted to stay on for a while, got a job in a publishing house, and it's a long story, but wound up within a year being the translator to the president. It was an extraordinary opportunity.
Mm-hmm. I think that that this period and this man have great resonance for people who find themselves politically on the left side of the spectrum.
Yes.
What, looking back on this, looking at the time that Salvador Allende was president of Chile, what sorts of things would you say he was responsible for in that country? In what ways would one have said that Allende made Chile a better place?
Well, that's a very good question. You know, if you allow me to answer it through the back door first,
sure.
Just to say what first, I think, for us was the issue of what he meant to people outside of the country. And I think that the election of Salvador Allende, who is often called the first freely elected Marxist head of state in the world, was something really extraordinary, because we were living in that superheated time of the late 60s and early 70s when a revolution was on the lips of many and social change was on the minds of many. And yet the models of social transformation that were around us were not very encouraging. I mean, those of us who protested the war in Vietnam and thought there might be a better way to go about doing things could hardly look to places like Russia or China as encouraging examples. These are countries that clearly had totalitarian governments. And what was so interesting about Chile was here you had a president who was a Marxist and a socialist, but who was also a lifelong Democrat, who had been a senator, a president of the Senate, and was elected freely in a country that already had very developed democratic institutions. And to answer the other part of your question, I think that's what was really extraordinary about Salvador Allende, because in the United States, we perhaps rightfully think of socialist experiments as those that, for better or for worse, in other aspects, roll back or even quash democratic life. In Chile, it was the opposite. This administration came to power and only enhanced what was already a thriving democracy. And in terms of the kind of concrete achievements that it was allowed to carry out before it was extinguished by the military coup, Allende came in and, you know, he had a 40-point program, David, and the first point on his program may not sound very exciting to us, but if you live in a place like Chile, it's a big deal. The first point on his program was a half a liter of milk for free every day to every child in Chile. And in a country where 30 or 40% of the population lives below the poverty line and where child malnutrition is endemic, that's quite a proposal. The second thing that Allende did that still stands, as a matter of fact, is that with the consent of the Congress, in fact, by a unanimous vote of the Chilean Congress, he nationalized the copper mines in Chile. Copper is the major natural resource in Chile. Some of the largest copper mines in the world are there. And they had been owned by the Kennecott and Anaconda copper companies of the United States. Allende nationalized that, and I think that, if nothing else, he's always going to be remembered in Chilean history for allowing the country to recuperate its natural resources. Mm.
I should introduce again our guest at this point, just for anyone who might have tuned in. We're talking with Mark Cooper. He's contributing editor of The Nation magazine, and if you listen to this station on Wednesday nights, you should recognize his voice. He's host of the syndicated program Radio Nation that we run. A lot of other stations do. His new book is an account of his experiences in Chile before, during, and after the coup of 1973. And again, the title of the book is Pinochet and Me, and it's published by Verso. It is out now in the bookstores. And questions are certainly welcome. 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. As you say, the government of the United States, and particularly the administration of Richard Nixon, was not happy about the election of, I guess that's putting it mildly, was not
right.
Happy
it's
about
the
election of Salvador Allende.
No.
Before talking about what happened around the coup, though, was the United States involved before that in taking actions attempting to prevent his election in the first place?
Oh, absolutely. Allende had run a couple of times before, and, the investigating commission of the United States Senate in 1975 or 6, the now called the Church Committee, which was the first real investigation into this, revealed that in the previous elections, in 1964 and in 1958, when Allende had run previously, the United States had, and the Central Intelligence Agency, had poured millions of dollars into the political campaign against him. Then in 1970, when Allende was elected, there was, David, a two-month period in between the time of his election and the time of his inauguration. We now know from the Church Committee hearings and more, even more importantly, from thousands of U.S. government documents that have been declassified just in the last 6 months I'm speaking of, we know to what degree the United States directly intervened in Chilean politics in that two-month period. Once Allende was elected, trying to prevent him from being inaugurated, we have evidence now in these documents of the Central Intelligence Agency as well as Henry Kissinger's office directly fomenting armed groups in Chile that wound up kidnapping the then commander-in-chief of the Chilean army, trying to provoke a military coup. The commander-in-chief, René Schneider, was killed in that bungled kidnapping. We know the United States provided automatic weapons, provided money for the people who carried it out. Of course, in this venture was collaborating also with the International Telephone and Telegraph Company, AT&T, which had put up its own $1 million fund to block Allende from being inaugurated. And then once Allende came to power and was inaugurated in any case at the very end of 1970, the covert destabilization program of the Nixon administration only escalated.
Just for a moment, I want to stay with the murder of General Schneider, and there we have a couple of callers I want to get to. Certainly the reason that I want to touch on this has to do with the attention that's now being given to Christopher Hitchens.
Yes.
And the articles that he wrote for Harper's, and then I guess there's a book-length treatment of this that's coming out titled The Trial of Henry Kissinger, in which Hitchens makes the argument that Kissinger is guilty of war crimes. And I think actually it's the same publishers as your book.
That's correct.
Verso, it'll be out sometime later in the spring, early in the summer. And when Hitchens was asked in some of the things that I've read about this, well, what are the worst things that you believe, you allege Kissinger was guilty of? The death of General Schneider is at the top of the list. In what do we know that Henry Kissinger was involved in? In what way was he involved?
Well, that's a really good question, and you've already partially answered it, because in the end I'm going to refer the listeners to the work of Christopher Hitchens, who I'm proud to have as both a friend and as a colleague at The Nation magazine. Christopher lays out in gruesome detail exactly what the level of Kissinger's involvement is, and it is far too complicated to go over right now on the radio because it involves an entire document trail. But those documents are not fabrications or figments of Christopher Hitchens' imagination. He got them when the United States government declassified them last November. And what we see very clearly, just to summarize it, is full knowledge of sections of the CIA and of the National Security Office and of Henry Kissinger himself, of the details of that operation that was carried out in Chile with direct U.S. support, that indeed resulted in the murder of the commander-in-chief of the Chilean Armed Forces. I mean, it's really kind of extraordinary. Imagine if it were the other way around here, what we would be saying about the intervening country. If we had some country that was financing a terrorist group that sent out a couple of cars to bottle up the commander of the Joint Chiefs of Staff of the Pentagon on some road in Arlington, Virginia, and trapped him in his car, came out with automatic weapons, shot him, and bundled him into a car, and then have him die in their hands, we'd be pretty worked up about it.
Mm. Well, I guess we'll refer people to Harper's. They want to read the articles, they may have to go to the library to find them, but they're there. And then in, I think, May is supposed to be the publication date.
The book is scheduled for publication in the next 6 weeks or so.
Yeah. Oh, okay. So even sooner than what I have seen. So folks can look for that. Maybe we'll even see if Mr. Hitchens can be on our show here.
Yeah.
In the meantime, here we have a couple of callers. We want to get to them, starting with Champagne, line number one. Hello.
Thank you. Good morning. Well, several things. I have long thought that Henry Kissinger should be tried for human rights and war crimes, not only for Chile, but any number of other things that he was involved in during his tenure in the government. But another thing you might be curious to know, that Urbana was actually the first place in the United States that Allende's widow came to live. Stayed with a family here in Urbana.
I had no idea.
For a while. also, I mean, if people want to get some sense of the extent of, just how they tried to destabilize things, I would refer people to an excellent analysis of cultural analysis by Dorfman and Mädelhart called How to Read Donald Duck, which does an analysis of how Disney comics were actually used to undermine the Allende government, trying to keep them first from coming to power, undermine the unions, all kinds of things.
Yeah, it's a good book, and it's just recently been reissued, and I really want to second that thought.
Yeah. Well, thank you for the program.
All right. Well, thank you. Let's go to Champaign County for the next caller here. It's line number 4. Hello.
I was going to ask about Dorfman and Mattelart, and maybe I can just expand it and ask you to go on about the internationalist dimension of the participation in the Chilean experiment, since you were right there. Another urbanic connection is that the L'Atelier Brigade came here and painted a mural on a wall in downtown Champaign, which is regrettably now gone and only saved in photographs. But the international dimension. I guess the other thing is that Chile's figures in domestic politics and pointed at as a example of privatization of
Social Security.
Social Security, and to point out that you said that one of the revolutionary proposals was a liter a day for children. Well, in this current circumstance, I have a figure that says that 27% of Chileans, working Chileans, make less than $2 a day. So I don't know how much of the model the U.S. wants to bring.
Right.
The other thing is that the military didn't participate in that. They have their own Social Security system outside of the privatization. So some things on those points, and I'll hang up and listen.
Okay, those are a bunch of great questions. Let me take let me at least take what I think to be the most important one, which is David asked me. You asked me, David, about what we can remember about Allende. Mm. Of course, Allende was only in power for 3 years. He was then followed by 17 years of Augusto Pinochet, who has unfortunately left a much greater mark on Chile than his predecessor. And to respond to the caller's question, I would say that the bloom is off the rose in terms of Chile as an economic model. It is extraordinary when you think about it that a country that was placed under a military dictatorship of the sort of Augusto Pinochet, a dictatorship that not only killed several thousand people, not only made 1,200 people disappear, and not only instituted systematic torture of tens of thousands of Chileans, not only forced a couple hundred thousand Chileans into exile, but a government, a military government that imposed a radical economic model on Chile. It is really kind of staggering when you think what sort of legitimacy and what sort of praise that regime garnered in the 1970s and 80s, even into the early 1980s, by conservative forces around the world and free market voices around the world that didn't blush at holding this place up as some kind of miracle. And, of course, this brings us to the present day. There's two problems with that. One, economically, Chile does not provide very well for its people. Anybody who cares to look even minimally at the real living conditions of average Chileans are going to see that the miracle is often how they get through the month. The second problem with holding up Chile any longer as some sort of economic model is to look at the fate of the guy who designed it. General Pinochet, 3 years ago, already retired as dictator, as he retired as commander-in-chief of the army, became an unelected senator for life in Chile with great honors. Today, 3 years later, thanks to his initial arrest in London and then what has transpired since, he's an indicted war criminal facing trial for his involvement in the barbaric murder and torture of 75 people just at the onset of his regime. So when you have a regime that's led by somebody like that, it ought to tell you to take it ought to be a warning to take a harder, colder look at the sort of economic and social model that he puts in place.
Yeah. Well, I certainly want to get on and have you talk a little bit more about the current status of Pinochet and where that's likely to go. I do have another caller here, though. Let's talk to them in Taylorville. That's line 2. Hello.
Yeah, good morning. I wish to point out that I think abominations like what happened in Chile back there in Nixon time, Nixonian time, would not have happened if we didn't have the sort of leadership we had. And if we talk about conservative by apparently latter 20th and early 21st century definition, means ruling class leadership, because that's really what we've got, and that's what we've had for a very, very long time. If we want to see what entropy is like, I suggest we hearken back to the times of FDR and Truman, and look at what's in the at 1600 Pennsylvania right now. I call it the Great Gazoop. It's a combination of kazoo and goop, the sort of kazoo that was made in perhaps Taiwanland. We're working. I think it should be absolutely required that children, even before they graduate junior high, learn something about our history and how it works. This regime in Chile wouldn't have happened if it hadn't been for people like Henry Kay, Strangelove, Kissinger, and the CIA. And the CIA works, it may be rationalized for the benefit of us all, but primarily it jumps like any well-trained doggy at the behest of its master. And Pinochet and his brother and possibly sister thugs would not be down there if it hadn't been for these machinations. I think it ought to be taught to our kids how our government works and what we're doing overseas. We overthrew a democracy, and we did the same in Guatemala back in the early 50s.
Yeah, I'm sure that Mr. Cooper will agree with probably everything that the caller had to say.
Well, I think that the only thing I'd say about that is the last point. You know, the when you grow up in the context of the Cold War, it sometimes becomes kind of a hall of mirrors, and you can't tell reality from myth. You know, we fought a Cold War supposedly in the name of democracy in order to battle totalitarianism. And in the case of Chile, the United States intervened politically and economically, again in the name of democracy, saying that Salvador Allende and his socialist administration had to be overthrown, because if not, the country would absolutely be led into the path of totalitarianism. The really bitter and tragic irony is that it was precisely the opposite. In the case of Chile, indeed, the United States wound up overthrowing a democracy and then helping to install one of the most authoritarian dictatorships in modern history. So it was not the Russians, but it was the United States who put in place a Pinochet government that abolished all political parties, suspended the Constitution, closed down the Congress, censored the press, and imposed a 10-year curfew on the country. And it is something that it would be best that we learn in our history.
We are already at our midpoint, a little bit past. Let me just real quickly mention our guest is Mark Cooper. He's contributing editor of The Nation magazine. He's also host of the radio program Radio Nation, a show that you can hear, by the way, on this station Wednesday nights at 10 o'clock. And he's also the author of a book, Pinochet and Me, about his experiences in Chile. The fact that he was a translator for President Salvador Allende at the time of the coup in 1973, an account of the rather harrowing experience that he had right after, how he managed to get out, and then also sections in the book about visits that he made back to Chile after that. So it covers in rather tight, elegant prose some of the highlights of about the last 30 years in that country, and the book is published by Verso, so if you're interested, you might seek it out. And, of course, questions. Welcome, 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. I do want to get back real quick here for a moment or two.
Sure.
To the charges that have been leveled against Pinochet. He, earlier this year, was charged with his involvement in this incident known as the Caravan of Death, where a number of people, 57 people were killed, people were kidnapped. All this happened shortly after the coup, and he was charged with being directly behind this. And now just recently there's been a small change. I think that another court looked at it and said, well, we can't prove that he was behind it. The most we can say is that we can charge him with covering up the fact that this had happened, and now I guess there's still some sort of question about Will he be tried? Will he be held accountable, and for what?
Well, you're right. The official status as to what General Pinochet is charged with is still being litigated in the Chilean courts as we speak this week. It was about 5 or 6 weeks ago that General Pinochet was finally indicted and formally indicted by a Chilean court on charges of murder and kidnapping. Those charges have been modified now by an appeals court to charge him with merely the cover-up of the murder and kidnapping. He is facing trial. His defense team is trying to negotiate out the terms, and they're also trying to get him excused from trial on grounds that he's not mentally fit any longer to stand trial. That may or may not come to pass. I personally don't think General Pinochet is ever going to reach trial, because I think in the end he will be excused for health reasons. But, David, the human rights advocates and the human rights activists and lawyers who have been working for 25 years on this case really declared victory 5 weeks ago, declared definitive victory when the general was formally indicted, because this is not about the issue here isn't about revenge. It isn't about taking a single 85-year-old former dictator and making sure that he does or doesn't go to jail. It's about something much bigger than that. It's about establishing the historical record for what it is, and it's about the country of Chile being able to, if you will, recover its own collective memory that Pinochet tried to erase. I just want to remind you that 3 years ago, before Pinochet was detained in London on an international warrant, this guy was untouchable. He was the sitting senator for life in the Chilean parliament, and he was scheduled to become president of the Chilean Senate. So this reversal of fortune for Pinochet is not about his personal punishment. It's about Chile's ability to finally set the historical record straight and to try and reach some modicum of justice on thousands of unresolved cases of murder and disappearance that had just been blocked for two decades in the Chilean legal system.
Yeah. I know that Pinochet still has defenders. There are still people in Chile who say in the equivalent of, well, he made the trains run on time. But I do wonder, from your perspective, what sort of the average Chilean thinks about this, and whether indeed they think this is something important for them and their country, or whether they're so absorbed with day-to-day concerns, particularly economic issues, that this is just not that important
right
to them.
Well, let us first deal with the question of Pinochet's support. The Chilean right wing has always been large, has been able to get usually 35% of the voters or more, on occasion more. General Pinochet's defenders per se, however, have rapidly and precipitously declined as his political fortunes have waned. The actual support for Pinochet right now is quite minimal in Chile. The second question that you ask about, what is the average public opinion? That's a curious question, because depending on how the question is asked in different polls, you usually see a fairly large majority, 60, 65, 70% of Chileans, when asked, agree that some sort of justice should be had, that General Pinochet either should be punished, or that the entire truth should come out, or that the victims of his regime should be compensated. The problem is that in Chile, there has been no political leadership given to this. The Chilean government, which is a civilian government, which has been in power now for a decade, and that is made up putatively of Pinochet's former civilian opponents, has been, the only word I can come up with is cowardly. Cowardly, reticent, and excessively cautious in dealing with any of the human rights issues. So what has happened in Chile in the last couple of years, which has been very good in terms of recovering historical memory and seeking justice. All of this has happened in spite of the Chilean government, not because of it.
Let's talk with someone else here. They're in Evanston, line number 4. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
David asked my first question. My second question is, can you explain the part that Milton Friedman played in the economics of Chile?
Yeah. Well, I got to say, David, you've got an incredibly well-educated audience.
Absolutely true. I wouldn't disagree with you at all.
Well, I must tell you, I'm 80 years old, but I just love this program, and so much heart I take from these young people who have come into the fore, and thank you, Mr. Cooper.
Well, thank you for calling me young. the question you asked is, what role did the U.S. economist Milton Friedman play in Chile?
Right.
The answer is that right after the military coup in 1973, the Chilean government adopted the economic philosophy of Milton Friedman and instituted what it called shock therapy, which was to severely cut back all government spending and plunge the country into a sort of planned depression or recession to lower inflation at the cost of tens of thousands of jobs, et cetera. Since then, Chile, as I mentioned before, has been in the forefront of the experimentation of kind of a radical capitalism, the most radical sort of capitalism, privatization of almost everything, from Social Security. Even what we know as the public schools have been essentially privatized in Chile. Medicine has been privatized. The basic utilities have been privatized. But as defenders of this have told me, as conservative Chilean economists have told me, this could only be done in Chile because there was a military dictatorship. You needed the force of bayonets and rifles in order to impose such a radical economic program on people that really put the bottom half of the country at great economic risk. And they are still there today as we speak.
Does that
answer
your question? All right.
Thanks.
Very good. Thank you. Well, let's go on to someone back here in Urbana, line 1. Mm-hmm. Hello.
Yeah, thanks. Mm-hmm. I was wondering if was the Allende particularly naive? It just seems, listening to how you got on to his staff, it just seems that it would be kind of risky to employ an American given what he had planned. And I was also wondering if, kind of in relation to that, were you ever approached to give information about Allende?
Well, there's a curveball question. The answer to this, I can answer the second question immediately and tell you no. I was never approached, if you're suggesting, by intelligence agencies to spy on the person I work for. With all due respect as well, I don't think it was particularly naive to employ an American as a translator. My job was to translate into mother tongue English, and you needed people to do that. I think it is naive. When we talk about naive, I think it's naive to think that U.S. intelligence services need to rely upon Americans. What we saw, in fact, in Chile was the opposite. All of the operations in Chile that were carried out by the CIA were carried out in terms of armed actions and really decisive actions, were carried out by Chileans on contract to the CIA or by Chilean right-wing political groups that had been financed by the CIA. So I don't think that one's biology has much to do with one's politics.
I'll ask one quick other question. I was just wondering if you could, from what I understand, the media there is very conservative. And is it true that are they still very insulated as far as getting information, getting some, you know, negative feedback about Pinochet?
Good question. The Chilean media is very conservative and very non-diverse, if you will, and has always tilted towards Pinochet. But what I can say is that the information that has come out in the last 2-3 years, and especially in the last year, has been so egregious and so shocking to Chileans that even the Chilean media has had to come along a great distance. Not the whole distance and not the entire way one would hope, but even the Chilean media has had to recently give a lot of coverage and recognition to the fact that a lot of very nasty things happened under the regime of General Pinochet.
Thanks.
All right, thank you. To another caller here, this is Munster, Indiana, line two.
Yes, I wanted to know, do we know everything that there is to know about the car bombing in Washington with the ambassador,
right,
Letelier, and that? And do you think that we will get to the bottom of it with Bush in the White House now?
Right.
Will the documents still be forthcoming?
Yes. The answer to you is we don't know everything. And the caller, if you'll allow me, David, the caller refers to the...
And I'll listen off the air.
Well, thanks for the call.
The caller refers to the September 1976 car bombing in downtown Washington, D.C., conducted by operatives of the Chilean secret police, a bombing that killed a former colleague of mine, the former Allende cabinet minister and foreign minister, Orlando Letelier, and his associate, Ronnie Moffitt. We know a lot about that now, and we know even more because in the latest release of declassified documents in November, there was even more material about that situation. But there's still some missing links. What I can say is that it is not a secret that the Department of Justice, in the last days, the last 6 months of the Clinton administration, began an active, they reactivated their investigation of General Pinochet's role in that murder, and in fact had ordered and got the compliance of the Chilean judiciary system to interview about 36 Chileans, to question 36 Chileans about General Pinochet's involvement in that murder. And there is still an open investigation into it, even under the Bush administration. Where that administration, where that investigation is going to go, and if the U.S. Justice Department indicts General Pinochet, as some would like to see for the car bombing, we still don't know. But amazingly enough, that investigation is active.
One of the stories that you tell in the book is the story of how it is after the coup you managed to get out.
Yeah.
And I heard you tell the story actually one night on Radio Nation. It's even more harrowing to read it as you describe it in the book. You were almost a little nonchalant on the radio interview, I thought. Actually, I think that now, having read the way that you write about it in the book. But I guess one of the things that's really striking about it is that it calls into question the notion that we probably all have, that if you're in a foreign country and you get in trouble, you can go to the embassy or the consulate and they will help you out. You were very lucky in that one individual, you were able to connect with one individual in the consulate who you said, you called the guy, you said, hey, I'm in trouble. The guy didn't even want to, he said, I don't want to know. He actually said, you can come to my apartment, and he helped you out. And it seemed that was rather fortunate, because due to your association with the government, you would have been one of those people certainly that the military would have rounded up.
Yeah, I was not in a good position at the time of the military coup, and I was in great danger. I had, very briefly, I had, as you can see in the book, I had spent the night before the coup at a friend's house by pure accident, who lived way out in the suburbs. And that was fortunate, because if I'd been living in my ordinary apartment, it would have been very ugly. But I did seek help, and I sought help from the U.S. Embassy. And you can, the listeners can read the details in my book, but the short version is they literally just hung up on us. And even a couple of days later, when some of us went and knocked on the door of the U.S. consulate when we knew that friends of ours were beginning to disappear, they still sent us home. And offered absolutely no protection or service at all. I was in such a panic that for a safe place to stay, that I remembered the name of the student affairs counselor in the U.S. Embassy. I'd never met the guy, but a friend of mine had told me once, shortly before the coup, that this guy was a good guy and that he was somebody who was a lot more open-minded than the rest of the folks at the U.S. Embassy. And I was desperate. I would have called, you know, I would have called anybody. I called him out of the blue. He didn't know me. I didn't know him. He said, "You're welcome to come stay with me." I, as you see in the book, I had kind of a harrowing experience getting to his apartment. Mm-hmm. And when I got there, he was very kind to me. But he told me, "Look, the good news is you can stay here. The bad news is, on the day of the coup," which had been like 4 days previous, he said, "On the day of the coup, the U.S. ambassador had asked for his passport, locked it in a safe, and sent him home. So this U.S. diplomat, low-level diplomat, who gave me shelter and gave others shelter, was himself a black sheep who was essentially excluded from the embassy at that time. And when I finally got out of Chile a handful of days later, he could do nothing for me, and the U.S. embassy did nothing for me. I was able to get out through friends in the Mexican embassy who put me in contact with the United Nations High Commissioner on Refugees. So really the role that the United States government played in that whole affair is really a very, very dark dark chapter in our history. Yeah.
Well, would this have gone differently if you were a different person? Was this because of who you were and your involvement with the Allende administration?
No, because I don't think that the embassy people that I dealt with when asking for help, they didn't have any idea who I was. I spoke to them on the phone, and I was not forthcoming with them. I didn't tell them, "Hey, I'm Allende's translator." Mm-hmm. I called up and said, "Hey, I'm a U.S. citizen who's stuck here." They didn't even have my name. And just over the phone, they basically said, "Get lost. We can't do anything." And when I went in person with a larger group, 4 or 5 days later, they had no idea who I was. I went with a group, and I didn't give my name, and I had no contact with them. So this was just their general policy. I imagine if you were an American business executive, you might have gotten somewhat better treatment. But if you were an American young person in Chile, and you were a student, or you know, you were somebody other than an executive for a multinational, I think the embassy figured you were reasonably suspect, and they weren't going to extend anything for you.
Yeah. You have important connections to Chile. Not only were you there at this very important time in the history of the country, but also you married a Chilean woman that right. you met when you were there, and so now you have Chilean family connections too. So obviously the connections for you are many and important, but in the book you write right up front that those 27 months I spent in Chile during the Allende period will forever mark me.
Yeah.
In what way do you think all of this went to make you the person that you are?
Well, you know, it isn't just me, because as you said, I married into a Chilean family, and I know many, many Chileans scattered across the world and in Chile, and we all say the same thing. All of us who lived through that experience find it to be, even now 3 decades later, the seminal experience in our life. And I think it is for two reasons. One is the best of reasons and the worst of reasons, because those of us who live through the Allende experience live through something really extraordinary. We really live through something really inspiring. We live through a couple of years where, through democratic means, ordinary people in a small, obscure country really got on their feet, really recovered their dignity, and really, in a very inspiring way, showed us the best, the very best that human society can produce. And we also are marked by that experience because it led to a military coup and a dictatorship, which in turn showed us the darkest part of our human soul. And when you live through those sort of extreme experiences, those are not something you just file away with your home movies about your trip to Hawaii. This is stuff that really, really seeps into your soul, it seeps into your psyche, and becomes part of who you are, and teaches you the hard way through the school of hard knocks that at times you can have the most amount of faith in people, and sometimes that faith can be very horribly betrayed.
Well, we'll have to leave it at that. I want to say, Mark, thanks very much for talking with us.
Thank you, David, and thanks to your great audience.
Our guest, Mark Cooper, he is contributing editor of The Nation magazine. He is also host of the nationally syndicated program Radio Nation, a show that you can hear on AM 580 Wednesday nights at 10 o'clock. And if you're interested in reading the book that we have talked about, once again, the title is Pinochet and Me. It's published by Verso.